This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the movie Minority Report, we're invited to imagine a world without murder. Psychics foretell future crimes and tip off a special police unit to arrest people before they can break the law.
Just 6 years ago, the homicide rate in this country had reached epidemic proportions. It seemed that only a miracle could stop the bloodshed. But instead of one miracle, we were given three, the precognitives. Within just 1 month under the pre-crime program, the murder rate in the District of Columbia was reduced 90%.
They were going to be waiting for me in the car.
He was going to rape me.
I was going to be stabbed.
Right here.
Within a year, pre-crime effectively stopped murder in our nation's capital. And now pre-crime can work for you.
We want to make absolutely certain that every American can bank on the utter infallibility of the system. And to ensure that what keeps us safe will also keep us free.
It makes for compelling science fiction, but could it become reality sooner than we think? Is it already here? Michael Rich is an associate professor at Elon University Law School, and in a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, he speculates on the dangers of trying to prevent crime by using technology to prevent the behavior that could lead to crime. Michael Rich joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you thinking about this?
Well, it was interestingly, I was listening to a piece on NPR last winter.
Those guys are great.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, it was about how the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration had recently asked states to outlaw the use of cell phones by drivers in cars. And a little part of that piece mentioned that there are some researchers at Rutgers who are developing technology that would actually block cell phone use only of the driver in the car. And that just got me thinking that it seems interesting that we might try to use technology to prevent what we otherwise would outlaw. Normally we punish, but in this case, we just keep you from doing it in the first place.
But if you think about it, the things come to mind. We know there are cars, for instance, that make it difficult for you to get into your car. They test you to see if you're drunk, right? And that technology is already here. You can imagine a breathalyzer test pretty quick that if you flunk the breathalyzer test in your car, the engine doesn't go on, and that could prevent drunk driving.
You got it. In fact, right now that those sorts of interlocks are used after somebody's been convicted of drunk driving, they'll have to install it in their own car. But the federal government's developing a program that would allow that technology in all cars, and it wouldn't be where you'd have to blow into a tube. It would actually measure your blood alcohol level just from the breath you exhale or by shining some light into your skin.
So what does that do? On the surface of it, that sounds great. Now, people really don't want to hurt anybody. And if they could actually be prevented from exercising their bad judgment, they'd be happy and we'd be a lot safer. That's not a bad thing.
Well, no. And I think in some situations it might not be a bad thing. Something like drunk driving we've decided is so bad that anytime you get behind the wheel of your car while you're intoxicated, whether you meant to or not, you're guilty of the crime. And so if we can prevent all of that activity, we're better off. But the thing is, most crimes that are out there require some sort of bad thinking going on in your head. And so before you're guilty of the crime, just because you did something that ended up causing somebody some harm, doesn't mean you're guilty of a crime. And I'm not sure that we necessarily want to stop everyone from ever doing anything bad. We have to give some sort of value to people's free will.
What impact would that have? If you could really, again, get into people's thoughts and predict that they're about to commit a murder. On the one hand, you would think that our legal system shouldn't be convicting people based on their thoughts.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think there's really two things going on here. One is there are a lot of situations where we try to, kind of prevent people from doing things once we've identified them as dangerous. Once we've noticed they're doing something that indicates they might commit further crimes, we'll put them in jail. We do that with folks who have been convicted of sex offenses. If we think they're a sexual predator, the society, we can imprison them or at least incapacitate them even after their sentence is completed. But that's more what Minority Report is about, right? That's just a way of identifying people who are particularly dangerous. And I don't know that I necessarily have a problem with that. I think the technology that's more interesting is the technology that affects everyone equally. No matter how dangerous, how likely you are to commit crime or not, it's going to keep you from doing something. And to me, that's something a little bit more troubling. It's treating everybody like a criminal.
And it really does have a strong bearing on this thing we think we value called free will.
Absolutely. We society in some sense, and particularly the criminal justice system, is based on this idea that, people have free will and have the capacity to make the right decision sometimes. And so we're not going to punish you just for thinking you want to commit a crime, because we want to give you that opportunity before you go through with it to change your mind. But this gets rid of that opportunity and in some ways, you know, really treats us, one could say, as a little bit less than human.
And it could be a little blunderbuss in the way that it controls our behavior. So even if you didn't prosecute me for my thought, if you were to do something, I mean, you can imagine a crowd control. We don't want riots. Mm-hmm. So we can develop technology that reads posture and body language, and people gathering is not so bad, but certain kinds of ambient gestures indicate violence, and therefore we're going to stop that crowd from gathering before it even collects.
That's right. As people begin to gather, maybe the police go in to break it up based on those sorts of gestures. And you're right. I mean, there's a concern there that of accuracy. We don't want to prevent people from doing stuff when really they weren't going to commit a crime. And you know, even and it's really hard to imagine having a technology that was perfectly tailored to only target criminal activity, especially when you're dealing with something like the right to associate, the right to free speech, those sorts of protected constitutional activities. We don't want to allow overbroad kind of prevention.
Would we need new theories of law to in a sense provide the architecture for this? As you say, our legal system is based on the fact that we have a free will, but if you go beyond this point, we've got sanctions for you.
I think we do. I mean, really, the entire point of my article, I mean, it's kind of fun, you know, fun kind of thing to think about. But I think there's a serious core, which is we need to recognize that these sorts of technologies are more and more likely to be available to the government. Because as technology becomes more central to our lives, that technology can both enable us to do new things, but then it also can be used to limit our scope of action. And so I want people to just kind of start thinking about when technologies come up, how do we think about it? I mean, what kind of principles can we have for when we're going to use technology to prevent crime and when we're not going to?
And in anything like this, whenever technology is involved, it always becomes an arms race. So mm-hmm. you can stop me from driving my car, but somebody's going to develop the software that's going to disable that so you can get behind the wheel.
Oh, absolutely.
You've had a couple drinks.
I mean, nothing is ever going to be perfect right. in that regard. I mean, you know, criminals, people generally have no end to their creativity, and criminals are certainly no exception. And so in some ways, what's going to happen is you will prevent the less dangerous folks from doing from committing criminal activity, and those who are only really, really committed to doing it will. And those are the dangerous people.
Beyond that, you'll start to outlaw that. I mean, in the same way that radar detectors mm-hmm. became illegal, you would outlaw anybody writing software that would disable this. Well, now we're getting into intellectual property, free speech. I mean, you're telling me I can't write software?
Well, it's interesting. We already do that, in fact. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is meant to, you know, protect online copyrighted stuff online and keep it from being copied, already outlaws the creation of technology that allows people to avoid certain copyright measures. So it's illegal to write software that makes it easy to, say, copy a video game. And so, you know, we're already doing that.
And we're in some pretty fierce debates about what that means for intellectual property law, mm-hmm. for and even free speech, all of which we thought we had nailed down pretty well under the old technologies. We got to rethink the whole thing.
Absolutely, you got it.
So and there are other ways in which this begins to creep and become truly more invasive. Nobody thinks that child pornography is a good thing. So if you found a way to limit people searching or downloading child pornography and prohibited it online as technology, you'd love it. That same technology could be used to limit my Google search on, for instance, whether banks have ever faced criminal charges. And now I suddenly can't do a show.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's really interesting. Britain has a program already that aims to prevent searches for child pornography. So what they have is this foundation, which is literally made up of four law enforcement agents. And they spend their days going through web pages that have been reported as obscene. And if they find one that they deem to contain obscene material, particularly child pornography, then it's added to a list, and internet service providers in Britain simply return an error message when somebody tries to access those web pages. Which, of course, sounds okay, again, if we're only talking about child pornography. But the problem is even there's been some amount of creep into things that maybe we're not so sure that we want to forbid. I was reading a news article from a couple years ago where there was an uproar there where they were considering preventing access to certain Amazon web pages based on the cover art of the CDs that were being sold there. And there you really run into problems of free speech. Isn't there artistic merit, even if it's somewhat disturbing in certain images, and who do we who are we going to empower to make that decision?
And if you think about what's going on, just in terms of the way we govern in different parts of the world too, because the technology is instantly global these days. So if you go to Russia and find out that in Pussy Riot's case, you could actually go to jail for 10 years for blasphemy. There are still places where you can do that. Obviously, it's not beyond the reach of any government to employ these technologies in that way.
Well, absolutely. And you know, when you have a government like Russia or like China or like the United States, which controls a lot of the kind of commerce, what we do matters for everyone, whether or not they actually agree.
So has there been a history of this? It would be interesting to know in the history of jurisprudence whether new technologies have forced new theories of law and forced people to sort of think differently about the whole structure of their legal system.
Well, it has happened over the last few decades as we've begun to focus less on punishing people who commit crimes and more on trying to prevent dangerous people particularly dangerous people from committing crimes. And you know, yeah, scholars have started thinking about it, and certainly courts have started to address it, particularly in the context, as I mentioned before, of sex offenders that we try to imprison. But it's certainly a slow process, and part of the problem, as I see it, with this sort of technology is it actually hinders the open conversation about the use of it, because once a certain activity has been forbidden, often that happens behind the scenes. People don't realize they're being prevented from doing something, and once they don't know that they're being prevented from doing it, they don't have any reason to ever consider that maybe they should be allowed to do it. And we don't have that sort of dialogue that's really important for making sure that our laws are just.
And the other thing, it seems to me, is that our superstitious belief in science and technology and its infallibility leads us to believe that perhaps you could find an individual who is more likely to, if you're uncomfortable with a blanket restriction, let's just find the people who are more likely to murder. And of course, that brings you right back to profiling, which we don't like. But I've got this technology now, and it's much better. I'm going to examine your DNA. Are we more comfortable with that than say a subjective judgment by a patrol officer on patrol that day?
Well, that's a really good question. I think in some ways we would be. I do think fortunately there is a bit of there's still a bit of fear of technology. We trust it in some areas, we don't in others. I think any of these technologies will face some resistance just based on that. That being said, I do think that that if it was sold the right way to the public, if it was seeking to prevent the right kind of activity, like child pornography, you know, like a crime as severe as murder or certainly terrorism, it would be a lot easier to sell. And then I don't think you'd have the pushback that you otherwise would have. And that's really where things get troubling.
These technologies, do you think, more likely to be used for those who are deemed one way or another by whatever process predisposed? Or do you think, just as a matter of jurisprudence, they're going to have to be applied to everybody across the board?
Well, I think certain technologies are just available in certain ways. I think initially, you know, your ignition interlock for drunk driving technology was most available for targeting those people we think are repeat offenders, because it requires you to blow into a tube, and that's a real imposition, and people would react negatively to that. But I think once the technology becomes less visible and can affect people without them even noticing, I think it becomes easier to just use it on everyone. And, you know, an argument could be made, though, that that's a good thing, because you no longer have the problems of racial profiling that you talked about earlier. Everybody's prevented from doing the criminal activity equally, regardless of race, regardless of age, regardless of sex or whatever.
Although these biases tend to find their way into almost everything, including software,
that's,
I suppose.
True.
Do you think this kind of technology is inevitable? It's going to happen. We're going to see more and more of it.
Well, I think it's certainly inevitable that it's out there. And it's just as we try to do new things, there will be people who will try to use technology to prevent us from doing things we don't want. So I think we just need to be aware that it's out there and pay attention and make sure that we're focused on when the government is trying to use it. Because, you know, what I find interesting about this federal government program to outlaw or to prevent drunk driving is that it's kind of flown under the radar. I mean, even though it's gotten some coverage in the press, most people don't know too much about it. And I think it behooves us to be aware of it before all of a sudden our congressperson is voting on it.
And there is technology. I mean, there's research going on that looks at ways we can examine people's thoughts. We can tell what people are thinking.
Absolutely. You know, we can both, you know, brain scans tell what people are thinking. There's, you know, pharmaceuticals that can be used to kind of suppress, you know, antisocial urges that we, you know, things we don't want people to be thinking about. We already use that in the case of sex offenders, you know, chemical castration and the like. And so the technology is certainly developing. And, you know, in some ways, you don't want to stop the science. So we need to be prepared as kind of a society to focus on the legal aspect.
Do you think, are there forums, are there sort of organized ways in which we can have this conversation?
Well, my kind of initial thought is that, you know, as a society, we typically, like I said, only outlaw, you know, activities when you have a bad thought going on in your head, even if you're just kind of acting in a way we'd call negligent or intentional. But there are certain crimes that we're going to prevent no matter what. They're so bad, they're so dangerous that we're going to stop you no matter what. You know, it seems to me that those crimes, I don't have a problem using technology to prevent. And that's at least one dichotomy we can look at. You know, beyond that, I think that's something that academics like me and also, you know, regular people are thinking about it, just kind of need to wrestle with. When are we okay with it and when are we not? You know, how far do we want to let the government go in restricting our freedom in order to keep us from coming to harm?
Well, thanks for getting the conversation going here today. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Rich is associate professor at Elon University Law School. His op-ed is called "The Perfect Non-Crime," and it appeared in the New York Times on August 6th. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. Our website, stateofthings.org. You can find a link to a calendar of events. You can listen to old programs if you want. You can hear this one over and over again. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.